I'm delighted to be joined here at our broadcast point at the Metropole Hotel by Dr. Mary Favier, COVID advisor to the Irish College of General Practitioners and member of NEFET. And first of all, it's lovely to see you in person, Mary, after all this time talking to you down the line. Walking around Cork last night, you know, there were so many young people out, you know, there was a sense of celebration, a lot of people nervous. But they weren't doing anything wrong, you know, they were just going out and there was music and they were wanting to party. So here we are, the restrictions, basically a lot of them lifted. You need your COVID passes and masks still, but that's basically it. Are you nervous?
The atmosphere in Cork this weekend was much anticipated and is a great pleasure to see. I mean, the buzz, the feel of it, it's really a tonic. Yes, there's a certain anxiety, and I think it's an appropriate one, entirely appropriate anxiety. For GPs on the ground, We have been really getting quite concerned in the last week or two. Our COVID numbers are rising. The amount of activity we undertake in general practice to do with COVID is it looks like those could double in the next month. As GPs, we'd have really significant concerns.
I mean, the NEFET projections show we could have up to 1,000 people in hospital by the end of November, don't they, if this doesn't go well?
Yeah, I think that's a reasonably conservative estimate. And it starts with an impact out on the ground in terms of, in general practice, the number of COVID cases being dealt with, but COVID impacting into GPs. A GP practice in Cork closed this week because of infections in staff. And the impact into people who get COVID is really significant in terms of, obviously, in practices, but a bit in workplaces. For people who then, there's particular vulnerabilities around people who live in very congested home environments. People who work in the precarious economy, those have particular difficulties around sick leave, staying out of work. So a rise in cases has very significant knock-on effects that aren't just into our health service, they're into our wider social economies.
You mentioned a GP practice closing, 1,800 health staff approximately out with COVID-related illness at the moment, which, you know, at a time of great pressure. Is that an argument for booster campaigns, for booster shots for healthcare workers like yesterday?
I think the sentiment there for boosting healthcare workers is obvious. I mean, because people feel exposed, they feel anxious, there's a ramping up of anxiety. The evidence to date is not there. But it's changing and it's been continually looked at by NIAC. In the next number of weeks, they'll look at it again. But the concern is there. A good significant proportion of our GP population is over the age of 60. We talk about people with underlying health conditions. GPs and healthcare workers have them. But 25% of the population will have an underlying health condition. Yeah. So it's something we can say quite flippantly, but very significantly affects a lot of people. So we need to be very careful and quite concerned. So going back to the great atmosphere in Cork, I think it's really good that atmosphere is outside, that we stay in well-ventilated areas, we obey all the restrictions, we put our masks on. And we're really careful about what's actually happening inside. A GP said to me yesterday alone that there's quite anxious, quite concerned that it's all starting to feel a bit like Christmas, and not said with a very positive tone. So we have to be really careful we don't return to where we were before.
And this is the question, indeed. A couple of people we spoke to last night, one of them was a publican. He was saying, you know, look, it's great. But what he was worried about is a couple of weeks of this could mean he's closed for Christmas. How real is that risk?
I think it's possible, not probable, but it's going to come down to our own individual behaviours, both as a community, but also in terms of those in the hospitality industry and all of us who provide services of any form, that we stick to regulations. And we're really careful and we actually ask the difficult questions. Do you have a COVID certificate? And deny entry if you don't. And that they're the risks we have. Now, vaccination is highly effective, so the stakes aren't the same as last Christmas, but we need to be very careful that we don't return there.
And the message again and again from government and the authorities has been about personal responsibility. Get your vaccination, wear your mask and wear it properly. But a lot of people are also confused, a bit nervous. Like, how responsible are they supposed to be? How willing are they supposed to be to walk out of a place where, you know, they've come to, or, you know, if they're on a bus or a train and they're not comfortable in their surroundings.
I mean, as an Irish community, we've done really, really well, and we've showed significant social solidarity. But there is a limit to that. There is a governmental responsibility. There is a hospitality sector responsibility to put procedures and you know, rules in place.
Because most people are wondering how people are going to socially distance 2 metres, you know, apart, queuing for a drink at a bar.
Indeed. And there are many conflicting parts of the rules. So the concern is that we've gone from what is supposed to be a very slow, gradual opening up to what looks like it's speeding up. And so there's conflicting messages in that. And for GPs on the ground, we're really feeling the impact. And for healthcare workers in hospitals, the same. And we really need to listen to people who have their feet on the ground, like the nurses' organisations, who can tell us that things are very difficult. There's no intensive care bed available in paediatrics as we speak. A majority of our hospitals have no intensive care beds available. So if there's a major road traffic accident or somebody has a significant cardiac surgery over the weekend, people are vulnerable. So the actions of us and our communities today, this weekend, will have an impact in 2 weeks' time.
Thank you for talking to us this morning. Thank you for joining us here in Cork. Dr. Mary Favier there, COVID advisor to the Irish College of General Practitioners and member of NEFIT.
Despite lockdown and a significant, albeit temporary, drop in transport use, Ireland's greenhouse gas emissions fell less last year than they did in 2019. A new report from the Environmental Protection Agency shows a reduction in emissions of 3.6%, but that's less than the 4% achieved in 2019 and nowhere near the 7% per year target contained in the Government Climate Action Plan. Laura Burke is Director General of the Environmental Protection Agency. Good morning, Laura, and thank you for coming in to us.
Good morning.
There was an expectation, and maybe it was misplaced, that the pandemic, with so much of society and industries closed or reduced, that this would help Ireland achieve its emissions targets in 2020. Was it misplaced?
Well, I think it was so difficult to predict last year because so much of our society and economy was stopped. We were trying to figure out what was the impact going to be. But I suppose the main impact we saw was in transport, and that wasn't surprising. We were all staying within 2 kilometres or 5 kilometres of our home, so therefore there really was a dramatic reduction in transport, albeit short-lived, and that is the rebound effect once people are out and about. Separately then, if you look at things like agricultural emissions, because agriculture production was continuing, it's unsurprising that there wasn't a COVID impact on agriculture. That said, it was very disappointing to see that agricultural emissions had increased in 2020, whereas they had decreased slightly in 2019. And then in the energy side of things, there was still a strong energy demand. So although there was a reduction in energy emissions, really because the reduced use of peat, which was really, really positive, and increased renewables, overall, it is disappointing. I think what we're seeing is that really the main impact or the main reason for reductions was those reduced transport emissions.
Talk to me as well about the increases in residential emissions and what fuels that.
Well, we were all at home more, and that really is, I suppose, an interesting one that we saw last year, 9% increase in residential emissions as people were at home more. People were heating their homes. Now, there was also, you might remember, the cost of oil, etc., reduced during the beginning of COVID, and maybe people were using their heating a little bit more because it was cheaper as well. But really, when we were at home more, we were heating our homes, and therefore emissions went up.
You mentioned the agriculture reduction, or I should say increase. Agriculture itself is continuing to resist, though, a reduction in the national herd. We had the IFA on the programme earlier this week, and they talk now of a stable herd, and you know, we've had arguments for them about increases in vehicle numbers in other sectors, passenger numbers through the airport, but they say that their cattle numbers have remained the same. Can agriculture continue as it is without reducing the national herd?
Well, from our perspective, what we're seeing is an increase in agriculture over the last 10 years, around 12%. So it's on the wrong trajectory. Rather than going down, it's going up. We're also seeing an increase as part of that in dairy cow numbers of 45%, a really significant increase. Now, ultimately, with regard to the agriculture sector, we need a significant, sustained, strong reduction in methane emissions, which come from cattle. It doesn't need to go to net zero like other sectors. So it's recognised that methane is a short-lived gas, that it is different to other greenhouse gases, but it is going in the wrong direction at the moment. With regard to the size of the herd, what we would say is that any increase in the dairy herd is unsustainable until there's solutions can be found for not only greenhouse gas emissions, but also impacts, for example, on water quality. But really, it is up to the sector now to identify how it can transform and change into the future so that we can also live up to the clean green image of Ireland that we promote when we're marketing our agriculture produce.
We're just a week out now from the COP26 International Climate Conference. You're a member of the Climate Change Advisory Council. Where is the promised carbon budget proposal?
Well, to be really clear, I'm not speaking here today on behalf of the Climate Council, and the Council are doing their deliberations, and I really won't go any further on that. But it's something that needs to be taken very seriously by the Council, so they need to take time to do that.
Yeah, but do we need those proposals, and do we need the government plan ahead of that international conference?
Well, we already have many, many identified actions in the 2019 Climate Action Plan, including almost 1 million electric vehicles on the road, 600,000 heat pumps, retrofitting of homes, and all of that can happen. We don't need to wait. And I think really for me, this report is a wake-up call that we need to take action. And I would be looking at all sectors. I would look not only at the agriculture sector, but the transport sector and the energy sector, because we are also seeing over the recent weeks talk of reusing, opening up money point and oil fired power stations, and they will have a significant impact on emissions.
We've been talking about wake-up calls for a number of years now, and nobody seems to be taking it seriously enough. We're nowhere near getting to that 51% that we need to get to by 2030.
And every year becomes more challenging. So this really has to be a tipping point. It has to be a turning point, and that we move from debate and discussion into action and supporting all of the sectors to take those actions.
Laura Burke, Director General of the EPA, thank you for coming into us this morning.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Discover our 2-to-1 offers at your local Kia dealer. For more, log on to kia.com.
Morning Ireland at 24 minutes to 8, coming to you from Dublin and from Cork. And the sports news now from Darren Frehill.
Good morning, Áine. The Irish team went down 1-0 last night to Sweden in the opening game of their World Cup qualifying campaign. What a performance, though. A Louise Quinn own goal, the difference between the sides. And it was one of those performances that just deserves so much more, but unfortunately not to be. The Irish team, of course, playing a team ranked second in the world at the moment. It was always going to be a tough ask, but a brilliant, brilliant performance from them. Unfortunately, one of our key players, Denise O'Sullivan, went off injured, and it looked like it was a shoulder injury, and that could mean she is a doubt for the Finland game, which is next Tuesday. Vera Powell is the Irish manager.
We're again stepping up, and we're getting closer and closer, and it's just such a shame that one moment of that our organisation did not link. If you look at the whole game, then I think we can be so proud, and I hope that Ireland is proud of these Tigers, because it's a shame that I'm so proud.
Yeah, we are too. More live action tonight on RTE2 with the Extra.ie FAI Cup semi-finals. Bohemians and Waterford are the live game on RTE2. St. Pat's meet Dundalk, both matches at 7:45. Wins for West Ham and Rangers in Europe last night. Tottenham lost, however. Leinster are away to Glasgow tonight in the United Rugby Championship. It's at 7:35. Let's hear from Stuart Lancaster from the Leinster coaching team. He's expecting a tough night ahead.
I think it's going to be a hell of a game. And I don't think anyone in our camp is underestimating, that's for sure. It's full of A, Scottish internationals, B, aspiring Scottish internationals, or C, really good overseas signings that they've made. So tough place to go. Hopefully a full house and just the challenge we need at this time of the season.
Yeah, big weekend ahead in Gaelic games with that vote on the football proposals tomorrow. Well, former Cork ladies football manager Aoife Fitzgerald is on the move. He has been confirmed as the new manager of the Waterford men's footballers for next season. Leona Maguire has a second round of 72. She remains 2 under par down the field at the BMW Championship in South Korea. Jonathan Caldwell is in a tie for 14th place at the Mallorca Golf Open. He's 4 under par. Paul Dunn is a shot further back. In hockey, both men and women's teams made great wins yesterday in the World Cup qualifying campaigns. The men are one win away from qualifying for the tournament after a 2-0 victory against Russia. Ben Walker scored both goals.
I think very relieved. Obviously, we've kind of looked at Russia over the last few months, so to get by that first, that's good. Now, clean sheet's always nice, and yeah, as I say, we're now just looking forward to Saturday.
Yeah, we are too. The women also going really well. Another important win for them, 4-1 against France. They are through to the semi-finals of that competition. But the problem for them is they need to win this competition outright to qualify for the World Cup finals. In cricket, very important day for the men's team. They face Namibia in the T20 World Cup, and only a win will see them progress to the next phase of the competition. It's an 11 a.m. start Irish time. And finally, racing today in Sligo is from 1:10, and there's also action in Dundalk from 4:45. Back to you, Mary.
Welcome back, you with Morning Ireland. That in the background is the sound of the New York Brass Band from York. And it wouldn't be the jazz, would it, without some music. And it's really, as we've been saying, you can really feel the atmosphere kicking off in Cork with the first jazz in 2 years kicking off this evening. And of course, this all following the lockdown and the easing of restrictions and entertainment that was announced last night. To talk about it all, I'm joined by the Irish Examiner news editor, Deirdre O'Shaughnessy, and a pleasure. Once again to see you in person, Deirdre. The sense in Cork, you know, Philip Nolan talking this week, we're on a knife edge. The restrictions being lifted last night, the jazz kicking off this weekend. It's a happy but a nervous happy.
It is a little bit. I'm actually getting a bit emotional listening to the music, Anya, because it's the first time I've heard live music in 2 years, and I think this is as close to the jazz as I'll be getting to this weekend. But it is the same as everywhere else, I suppose, Anya. We're all on sort of a knife edge, looking at the reopening of the restrictions, lifting of some of the restrictions, and things, you know, potentially going back to some kind of normal, but with the numbers that we have in hospital and the numbers of cases that we're seeing every day, I think most people are aware that, you know, at some point things have to go back to some kind of normal, and we, you know, we've done what we can do with vaccinations for the most part, but there are a lot of nerves out there, I think. You know, we're looking at standing events up to 1,500 people. Would you go into a room with 1,500 people? I don't think I would. But listening to this, I might be tempted. And, you know, I suppose that's the thing. We've forgotten what it's like to go and do things and be among people. You know, I had a casual conversation with the band this morning, and it's a long time since I was sitting anywhere with strangers that I felt I could talk to. So we're looking at 100% capacity for nightclubs. What goes on in nightclubs normally will go on in nightclubs, and as your Vox Pop was hearing, some young people don't know what goes on in nightclubs.
I know
yet.
We met these, you'll hear them later, we met these lovely girls last night, and when I asked them about that, they said, but we've never been to nightclubs. Yeah. We don't know how it works.
They've missed out on so much, and you know those are essential parts of growing up, much as we might cringe looking back at them. You know, the 11:30 p.m. closing is scrapped. I don't know if you've been to the pub while it closes at 11:30 on
I'm
the dot.
I'm in bed too early.
You are, but let me tell you, it's a bit of a different experience. And we're looking at socially distanced queuing for bars, which I have no idea how that's going to work. I think Catherine Martin might have forgotten what pubs are like as well. So we're looking at getting back to something. The COVID digital cert are going to be the key part of all of this to make sure that we're surrounded by vaccinated people. I don't know about that, Anya. I've been to a couple of places this week alone where I haven't been asked for them and where they haven't been asking anyone. So I really don't know how they're going to police that.
Right. The other thing you notice, of course, coming into Cork at the moment is it's a bit hard to get here at the moment.
Yeah, it's like we've done our level best to keep you all out. My colleague Michael Moynihan summed it up really well yesterday. He said, you know, well, we can look at it in a good way in terms of nobody's going to be asking us for coddle to keep all the dubs out, I think, as he was kind of trying to make a positive of it. But yeah, I mean, the transport situation is a bit crazy. I know you have Neil McCarthy on from the airport who's going to explain to you why the airport is currently closed, but the airport is currently closed. The train lines are currently closed. I live in Cove. The Cove Middleton, the Cove and Middleton lines are currently closed. The Mallow line is currently closed, so they're bus transfers. So if you have booked a ticket to come down from Dublin, you'll be transferred by bus from Mallow, which isn't the most glamorous thing in the world, but you know, you'll get here eventually. And there's roadworks on the Dunkettle.
The Dunkettle roadworks are like something from Mars, aren't they?
They are, yeah. You're kind of, every time I have to go through them now, I'm sort of gritting my teeth going, I don't know where any of this is going to begin or end. The lanes are changing, everything is changing, yeah. There's cones everywhere. So it is a bit chaotic. Now, all of these things have been done now for different reasons, and the reasons stack up on their own, but when you add them all together, it doesn't make an awful lot of sense.
Two Cork stories, national stories as well, I want to talk to you about. First of all, Whitegate. We all know about the energy crunch,
yeah,
and Whitegate's been offline. The news there?
Yeah, Whitegate is a big part of the reason that we're facing an energy crunch. There was a fault there last year, and it was expected to remain offline until 2022, but Eamon Ryan has said that it is to return in December. I don't know how fast they're able to do that maintenance. Hopefully it will, because we certainly don't want to be looking at blackouts, but Whitegate is a crucial part of the energy infrastructure.
And the story we heard about from Fiona, and it says in the papers, the rats in Cork County Council.
Yeah, my colleague Liz Dunphy was covering this one yesterday, and it was a Cork County Council worker, John O'Neill, who captured two rats and drove them to his place of work after a row with his manager. I mean, we've all had a row with our manager, but it's a pretty drastic action to take. But Judge James McNulty took a very dim view of it. He said it was a uniquely wicked act, and he gave him a 6-month sentence, which is pretty hefty for something like that.
Yeah, and the rats certainly did what rats do.
They sure did. They chewed through computer cables, they chewed on keyboards, they defecated everywhere. I'd say it was a pretty horrific scene to come in on. If you open the door, if you're the first person to open that door, I'd say whoever that was probably needs counselling.
All right. Well, listen, a pleasure, as I say, to talk to you. Thank you for joining us here at the Metropole this morning. That's Deirdre O'Shaughnessy, the news editor with the Irish Examiner. And our thanks, too, to the New York Brass Band, looking very fetching as well in their tartan shorts there. And thank you for the music, guys.
It's day two of the Summit of European Leaders in Brussels. And so far, the Polish challenge to the authority of European law has dominated, with Michal Martin saying Poland had gone too far. Today, deepening concerns over energy prices and the standoff with Belarus. They'll also be down for discussion. Our Europe editor, Tony Connolly, has been updating me on overnight developments.
Well, they spent a long time, Mary, talking about Poland and this real challenge to the primacy of EU law. And many EU leaders feel that Poland has gone too far, and it really poses a grave constitutional threat to the EU, because if one country decides to interpret EU law in a different way to everybody else, then the system simply can't function. But I think there was a concerted effort yesterday to de-escalate the tension around this, that they didn't want to have a shouting match between EU leaders and Poland. And of course, Poland is supported by Hungary. So in the end, quite a few countries said, look, the European Commission should continue its legal action against Poland. And that's happening on several fronts. And I suppose in the background, everyone's waiting for the European Court of Justice to come up with its ruling on whether or not Europe can basically deprive Poland of COVID recovery funding or EU structural or cohesion funding if it doesn't come back into line. I suppose ultimately there is a sanction against a country that persistently offends the EU's values and rule book, and that is Article 7, which would ultimately strip Poland of its voting rights. But of course, that requires unanimity, and Poland for the moment still has the support of Hungary. So that option seems to be kind of closed off.
Well, Tony, if they succeed and manage to park the Polish question for today, what will be the main issues for discussion?
Well, as well as Poland last night, they discussed the energy crisis. And there is real worry across Europe about the spike in gas prices, how that's affecting consumers and industry. But again, I think there was an acknowledgement that there's only so much that Europe can do. Leaders said that the European Commission should look at things like a strategic gas reserve in the same way that Europe bought vaccines in bulk for member states. Could something similar be done for the purchase of natural gas? And of course, there is a global shortage of gas at the moment. But again, I think there was a recognition that it's really up to member states themselves to manage the energy crisis, gas prices and so on, by taking measures to support consumers, perhaps have energy caps and so on. But you know, this is something that they are worried about. They're worried about the dependence on Russia for natural gas. Overnight, Vladimir Putin saying that gas from Russia could increase by 10% if Germany would recognize the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is a highly controversial pipeline linking Russia with Germany. Today, they're going to be looking at migration. There have been there's been another big wave of irregular migration from the Middle East and Africa into the Balkans and into countries like Greece and Italy and Spain. But a big concern, of course, as well is Belarus, the fact that the leader of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, has been effectively flying refugees and migrants in from around the world and depositing them on Europe's doorstep in on the Lithuanian, Latvian and Polish borders. And this will be an issue for Micheál Martin as well, because there have been some there's been some disquiet that aircraft leasing companies that are registered in Ireland are being leased to the Belarusian government to do this kind of work. And the question will come up as to whether or not they should face sanctions and what implications that might have for the sector in Ireland.
Tony Connolly reporting there. And
Bank of Ireland is to buy most of KBC Bank Ireland's performing loans and deposits in a €5 billion deal. It will see Bank of Ireland take on a portfolio including around €8.8 billion of performing mortgages and €4.4 billion of deposits. KBC Bank Ireland said customers do not need to take any immediate action following the deal. Well, pre-pandemic, Cork Airport was the second busiest airport in the state, but it's currently the quietest, with its doors temporarily closed while it undertakes a major runway reconstruction. It's set to reopen exactly a month from now on the 22nd of November, and the airport's managing director Neil McCarthy is here to talk about its recovery plans from there. Neil, firstly, are you confident services will resume this day next month, and what level of service will be in place from that point?
So thank you, Adam, and good morning. First of all, let me give you a bit of context. It's been a really difficult 18 months for everyone in aviation and tourism through COVID. So we lost most of our airline base, and we lost over 50 scheduled routes, and obviously all of our commercial concessions collapsed, you know, the food and beverage and Bureau de Change and so on. We were open throughout the pandemic with two routes, Heathrow and Amsterdam, and that was providing essential connectivity for into two major hubs and also for cargo as well. So we've taken the opportunity to expedite our capital investment programme. We want to bounce back strongly next year, and we will bounce back strongly. We've secured funding of over €40 million, €10 million from the government, for three major projects, the biggest of which is our runway reconstruction. And so we secured funding in November last year. We had to EU tender it. We had to design it, we had to get all the regulatory approvals, and we will have it completed in a really fast track 10-week round-the-clock construction, which finishes in 22nd November. So to answer your question in terms of next year, are we confident about recovery? We are confident about recovery. We're very grateful for the support from the government. We're not complacent. It will take 3 to 4 years to recover. But next year, we've secured 8 scheduled airlines to operate out of Cork. And they will operate 36 routes signed up so far. So to give you a flavour of those, Ryanair will be operating maybe 22 routes, Aer Lingus operating 6 routes, KLM into Amsterdam, Vueling into Paris, Swiss into Geneva and into Zurich, Air France into Paris as well, TUI to Holiday Resorts and Lufthansa. And we're still talking to more airlines. We're talking to 3 more airlines. So potentially next year we'll have 40 routes.
That's all to come, of course. But you must be looking enviously at other airports already ramping up their services and benefiting from all that pent-up demand. They've stolen a march on the recovery. So in hindsight, was it the wrong time to upgrade the runway? Or maybe should you have done it slightly earlier so you were ready to go at this stage?
The alternative was to do at the end of next year. And so to give you context, we will have 1.8 million passengers next year. We had 2.6 million in 2019. That's a 70% bounce back. So it is the right time. We're getting it done in a shoulder period. We're open for the summer. this year. The airlines asked us to stay open for the summer, and we did do so. And we've closed for 10 weeks in what is an off-peak period when the kids are back at school. We're getting deeply intrusive runway reconstruction works out of the way in record time. And we'll be bouncing back on time, 22nd November. Taoiseach will reopen the airport. It's an on-time, on-budget construction project, the fastest ever major construction project in the state in terms of from funding to completion, 1 year right through EU approvals. So no, we didn't want any interruptions next year. We're confident on recovery, and Cork will be Ireland's largest, second largest airport after Dublin once again in 2022.
Briefly, you mentioned next year's forecast, about 1.8 million passengers. When do you think you'll get back to those pre-pandemic levels of 2019?
Our chairman was before the Oireachtas committee this week, and he said 3 to 4 years, and that would be our forecast as well. Business traffic is hard to forecast. A lot of companies have cut back hugely. There's going to be a bit of Zoom, a bit of Teams. So that's, you know, between 15 and 20% of your business. So how quickly will that come back? We don't know.
Okay.
But definitely next year we'll hit 70%. Now, the Tourism Industry Confederation is forecasting 60%, so we'll outperform that by 10% in Cork.
Neil McCarthy, Managing Director of Cork Airport, thank you very much for that.
The reopening of the hospitality sector in the Republic from today, yesterday's service to mark the centenary of Northern Ireland, and the prison sentence given to the disgruntled council worker who released rats into his office in Cork are some of the stories covered on your front pages this morning. The Irish Examiner leads with the line that the government is pressing ahead with an almost full reopening of hospitality and entertainment from today, despite HSE warnings that the health service is under very serious pressure. And in its lead story, the Irish Times notes that the government has made major concessions to the hospitality industry. For its lead story, the Irish Independent reports that as more than 1,800 HSE staff are out due to COVID-related issues, University Hospital Limerick and Galway University Hospital have both confirmed that they have had to cancel operations. The arrest of Gary Vickery, a senior associate of the Kinahan organised crime gang in Lanzarote, is covered on the front of today's Irish Sun. The 38-year-old Dubliner pleaded guilty in a UK court last year to conspiring to import over £23 million worth of drugs and to laundering cash for the organised crime group following a four-year joint investigation by the Gardaí and police in the UK, but he repeatedly failed to show up in court after he was granted bail. The Irish News leads with comments made by Boris Johnson on his visit to Armagh yesterday, in which he said that he believes that the way the post-Brexit agreement is being interpreted is not coherent with the principles of the Good Friday Agreement. The picture on the front of today's Irish Times, meanwhile, is of the British Prime Minister chatting with the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Simon Coveney, and the Catholic Archbishop of Armagh, Eamon Martin, outside St Patrick's Cathedral following yesterday's service to mark the centenary of Northern Ireland. The service receives extensive coverage in many of today's papers. The Examiner flags Alison O'Connor's analysis on its front page under the headline, "Higgins was wrong." The Irish Daily Mail gives front page coverage to allegations made by six students from the Munster Technological University that they had their drink spiked at a Freshers' Week event in a venue in Tralee last week. The Irish Daily Star and Irish Daily Mirror both lead today with the six-month prison sentence given to 61-year-old former council employee John O'Neill, who admitted to trapping two rats and releasing them into the offices of Cork County Council in Kinsale because he had a grievance with one of his managers. Over the course of 3 days last February, the rats caused €3,000 worth of damage, chewing through electrical cables and damaging computer keyboards before they were eventually caught. Judge James McNulty described O'Neill's offence as an act of unique wickedness. "You dirty rat," is the headline in the Mirror, while the Star runs with, "It's a rat trap and you've been caught." And finally, there's a nice picture on the front of today's Examiner of husband and wife, Philip and Marion Mortell from Ballinlough, County Cork, who both conferred with doctorates at Mary Immaculate College in Limerick yesterday. After they retired, instead of putting their feet up, the couple decided to do a Master's in Theology and Religious Studies before undertaking their PhDs. And Marion's advice to anyone considering a return to education is, go for it.
Now, when we arrived here in Cork yesterday evening, the news about the new guidelines for hospitality and nightlife was only breaking. But already you could sense the party atmosphere that's built up as the city gets ready to celebrate the first jazz festival in nearly 2 years. And walking around last night, it really did feel a lot like the old normal. But with COVID cases growing at a rate of 2 to 3% a day right now, there's a nervousness about too. So I asked some of the people we met how they feel about the changes and who else to check in with first, but a Cork taxi driver we met on Patrick Street.
To be quite honest, I'd be a little bit nervous, especially with the numbers rising.
And here you are, you're driving a taxi, so there's going to be people coming from all over here this weekend.
Absolutely, absolutely. But it's all living, what do we do? But I would say to people, be careful, make sure the hands are washed thoroughly, make sure you wear your mask, make sure anybody getting into your cab has a mask as well.
Like, I think it's good, but at the same time, I'm kind of unsure because I feel like the cases will go up higher and higher, and then we might end up back in lockdown by Christmas. Well, for Jazz Weekend and for Halloween and the next couple of weeks, it's going to be absolutely packed. It's going to be like a COVID hotspot for our age group anyways. And I'm only 24, so I just finished college just before COVID. So I would usually be like first into the nightclub, but I'd say for the time being, I'll be staying with pubs and like trying to avoid getting COVID.
Guys, would you mind if I asked you a quick question for Morning Ireland? It's your premises.
Very, very nervous. Even just tonight now, we've been very, very busy before the Opera House, checking COVID passes, checking certs, trying to keep everyone safe. I just don't know what's going to be ahead of us for the weekend. All I can say from Jim Cashin's bar, if you don't have a COVID cert, you won't be coming in. This weekend could go pear-shaped for us and we'd be closed for Christmas. Us publicans, we do not want to be closed for Christmas. We need the guidelines to be specific, not 2 days before the event. We need the legislation to be put down in black and white and leave us get on with our lives.
It's to get into weather tunes.
So you girls are out partying for the night?
Yeah. That's the idea anyway. We're not sure what places are actually taking into account the new regulations. I feel like a lot of the bars are actually staying the same for the night and then changing tomorrow, but we're not sure
if
yet.
If there's somewhere open at midnight,
we'll probably be there.
You'll probably be there?
Most likely.
And you're looking gorgeous.
Thank you.
Out in the town. But are you girls worried about the COVID numbers and what you've been hearing?
Well, definitely. I mean, there hasn't been much talk of it since we've come to college. We thought there would be, like, more of an issue.
You definitely have to have them in, like, the walk-in clinics and everything around, like, the college and stuff like that. So if anybody's ever worried about it, we can go in there to get checked. You know.
And does that make you feel safe coming out
definitely,
tonight?
Yeah.
The fact that you can go and get checked anytime
definitely.
You need
yeah.
to? And come here to me. You know when the Taoiseach says what normally happens in a nightclub will continue to happen in a nightclub. Do you know what he means?
No, we're not completely sure what's going to happen. Like, I mean, this is kind of our normality now. Like, when they say it's going to go back to normal in a nightclub, we don't know what that's going to be like yet. You know, it's definitely not going to be what it would have been like 2 years ago, I imagine. Like,
good luck, girl. Thank you.
Thank you.
They were absolutely gorgeous. I hope they had a lovely night. But a sign of the impact of lockdown, these girls didn't know what happens inside a nightclub. It's 16 minutes past eight.
Elation, joy and some caution there from Cork. And there are some sobering numbers on the healthcare side to be considered. We're joined by Paul Reid, the Chief Executive of the HSE. He's in our Sligo studio. And Paul Reid, good morning to you.
Good morning, Mary.
And we heard the excitement of those young girls there. And I know we've heard the anxiety as well from GPs and ICU doctors about the pressures that they and other hospital staff are under. Now, when you take the impact of the latest infection numbers we're seeing, over 2,000 a day, translate into hospital admissions, what lies ahead?
Good morning, Mary. Yeah, and it was interesting your earlier Vox Pops as well, and you do get that common thread of apprehension and excitement coming through on all of them today. So that's probably where the whole society feels at the moment, specifically related to hospitalisations. What we're seeing at the moment, last night's figures came down, thankfully, to about 437 and 88 in ICU. But the reality of that is we know that will grow over the coming weekend and most likely over the coming weeks. If you look at the modelling projections from NPHET, they're forecasting potentially 1,000 people in hospital and 150 people in ICU, which really doesn't look off the wall in terms of what we're seeing, the trends at the moment. So our concern is particularly that lag effect we're all used to seeing, where we have high levels of cases over the last two weeks in particular, and how they will turn into hospitalizations over a coming couple of weeks. But in simple terms, Mary, I'd say a few very simple messages. First of all, I think the last couple of weeks should be a very real rain check for us all. And firstly, for those people who are vaccinated, it is a very strong warning for us all to strengthen. We do have stronger protections because we're fully vaccinated, but we do need to strengthen the basic levels of defences and those public health measures. And if you are unvaccinated, you are at much higher risk. You put your family, you put your friends at higher risk in society. And we are there to answer any of your concerns and encourage everybody in the common good to come forward for vaccinations.
But if those modelling numbers are realised, those numbers you gave us there, and there's no reason to believe they won't, 1,000 in hospital, between 150 and 200 in ICU, what then is your plan?
Well, we've had a number of plans throughout COVID in terms of how we meet rising cases. Nobody expects, based on the levels of protection that we now have in society, to get where we were in January, where we had over 2,000 people in hospital and 220 people in ICU. What we had to do then was completely cease all non-urgent care and non-COVID care, which we know the impacts of. So what we are doing right now as we head in throughout the winter is trying to sustain those levels of actions that in the public ensure that those numbers don't materialise, but from our hospital and healthcare system, a number of actions to continue to work to ensure elective care continues. But as you've seen and as reported this morning, a number of sites are not in a position.
That's right. We're seeing a cancellation of electives already in Limerick and Galway.
Yeah, and our concern as we head into winter, Mary, is a range of factors that are really working against us at the moment. So first of all, we know that we have high numbers of COVID cases and likely to rise. We're also seeing high numbers of people presenting to our emergency departments with non-COVID care, but care that has been neglected for some time, and we're anxious to treat that. Along with that, what we are seeing is early indications of what's called RSV, but simple terms, respiratory illnesses in young children, which is an indication of respiratory illness in the adult population through winter, and then the first identifications of flu coming through. So all of that are a whole suite of measures.
You're heading for a bit of a perfect storm there with the infections that you're talking about. At what point, Paul Reid, do you trigger surge capacity?
Well, I think the what I want to caution is that its surge is a magic button we press and, you know, we immediately increase all capacity. Well, but what does happen? There's no one single number, Mary, and each hospital has to approach this on a site-by-site basis, and then on a national basis we look at it. But what surge really means is, first of all, from ICU, we have just short of 300 ICU beds. If 150 of those or half of those are taken up through COVID, well then, yes, we have to bring on more capacity, but we equally have to stop some elements of elective care. Surge means redeploying significant elements of our workforce from non-COVID care, closing wards where we would have had emergency or other procedures happening, and moving skilled staff to increase ICU capacity. So surge is not a magic switch that solves an issue. Surge is a process that strengthens our capacity around COVID.
And would it be fair to say then it cripples other areas of the health service?
It would ultimately if we get there, Mary, but you know, I would like to say to the public this morning, we can turn this around. You know, the indications of how this turned around in the negative way so quickly, equally we can turn this around in a positive way over the coming weeks. And I know we're all sounding like a broken record going back to the basic measures, but we don't want to see that surge activated. We don't want to see elective care turn back. And the way we know we can address it is, and we know we've all slipped over the last few weeks, just getting back to, as society opens, and we welcome that, getting back to the really good public health measures. And it's equally called to enterprise and industry. You know, we individually, we collectively get back to mask wearing in appropriate way, social distancing, cleansing our hands, but equally for industry, making sure, particularly service industry and all industry, making sure that those levels of protection there as people are back in the workplace, making sure the facilities are there. You know, I've seen it, Mary, we've all seen it, people back at workplace, more meetings happening, more people in a meeting room, maybe not the ventilation that should be there. They're basic measures that we can strengthen over the coming weeks to stop this scenario.
How worried are you? And, you know, we're hearing about the Cork Jazz Festival going ahead this weekend, nightclubs back in business, reduced restrictions around the entertainment industry. How worried are you? We heard Mary Favier earlier saying, you know, some people are talking about Christmas all over again.
Yeah, look, it's particularly a concern for the health services heading into winter. It's a specifically a concern now as we see the impacts of COVID heading into winter. So yes, that is a strong concern for us. I do equally need to put in context, because throughout COVID, we've seen the wider impacts on the health service through, you know, quite difficult and punitive restrictions that have had to be put in place. So, you know, people's mental health, people's well-being, non-COVID care. So, you know, we obviously welcome that we're in a position for society to open further. But we equally would stress it's a really big rain check for us all to just manage the opening of society in a very safe way at an individual, collective level, business and enterprise level. You know, so strong concerns as we head into the coming weeks.
And you're encouraging people who haven't been vaccinated to take up the opportunity for vaccination. You also at the moment have 1,800 HSE workers out with COVID-related illnesses. Would you like an early decision from NIAC now on boosters for healthcare workers?
And just briefly on those people who are unvaccinated, it's not one single homogenous group of 370,000 people. So we've a range of initiatives, and I would encourage people, you will see campaigns and initiatives from us throughout the next week for walk-in clinics. We're addressing people in vulnerable areas, pregnancy, fertility concerns that people have, non-English speaking, vulnerable groups, third level colleges. So we've a lot of initiatives, encourage people to take that up, specifically related to people out with COVID. Yes, we have a significant proportion of healthcare staff out. From my perspective, obviously, I'm really anxious to see healthcare workers booster vaccines campaigns. Now, I'll qualify that. I'm not the medical expert on this one, and NIAC are the medical expertise. So they are the ones who are assessing the evidence and evaluating. But certainly from a health service perspective, I would have two concerns. One is for a workforce who may become ill and out sick, and the impacts that has on the health service. And secondly, what we are seeing are emerging outbreaks within healthcare settings. Now, that's a natural function of when it rises in the community, we see outbreaks in hospital settings. But certainly, my role in running the HSE, I'd be anxious to see our healthcare staff receiving booster vaccines, but I always qualify it, NIAC. And in fairness to NIAC, all of their decisions is what's resulted in very strong uptake in the public.
You had good news for maternity services yesterday, saying significant others will be in the labour wards with their partners. Does that mean that local discretion is now gone in the maternity wards around the country?
Yeah, first of all, I want to acknowledge that this has been a concerning issue for young moms, pregnant women and their partners. And we've been very anxious to address any anomalies that have emerged. A range of restrictions were removed between scans, early pregnancy assessment units, emergency presentations, labour ward and the intensive care units. What we have looked at in the past couple of weeks are National Maternity Hospital and indeed Rotunda, who have removed any further restrictions in inpatient areas between the hours of 8 to 8. And we have seen, and working with those hospitals, we haven't seen any rise or impacts. Okay. I will always qualify that, Mary. We do have concerns, and our hospital have concerns, just in terms of there is a lower uptake of pregnant women of the vaccine. We have seen 12 pregnant women admitted to ICU between the period of June to October, and 11 of those were not vaccinated. One was partially vaccinated. So, a strong call to pregnant women as well to seek the guidance of their professional. Yeah, medic.
Paul Reid, Chief Executive of the HSE, thank you.
The Environmental Protection Agency has published its 2020 report on Ireland's carbon emissions, and as their DG Laura Burke told Mary earlier, lockdown resulted in an almost 16% drop in carbon emissions from transport, energy emissions also down nearly 8% due to the ending of peat fuel generation. But because we were staying at home, the greenhouse gases from our homes were up 9%, agricultural emissions also up slightly, as was the side of the dairy herd. So all in all, thanks to lockdown, our carbon emissions were down 3.6% last year. But is that anywhere near enough? Not so, says our next guest. She's Dr. Hannah Daly, lecturer in energy systems at UCC. An awful lot of data here, Hannah Daly. What does it add up to as far as you're concerned?
What it means is that we're far from being on track to meeting our Paris Agreement obligations. The UN Secretary General said that climate is a code red for humanity and that we're at the verge of an abyss. And that's not just rhetoric. The Dáil has declared a climate emergency, and young people who I lecture are frightened, they're angry, and they feel powerless because they didn't cause this climate issue, but they're going to have to deal with it. They're going to have to solve it. And we need to show them that we're meaningfully going to deal with this. The 3.6% reduction in emissions last year is only half the progress that we need to make every single year to meet our climate obligations. The Climate Change Advisory Council is about to announce its first set of recommended carbon budgets between now and 2030. And irrespective of what that number is, we have to remember that we're already in the first carbon budget period. So no matter what happens, each tonne of carbon that's emitted now takes away from our collective carbon budget.
And the burden of cutting carbon is going to have to be shared between sectors. Now, one of the controversial sectors here in terms of that burden sharing, of course, is agriculture. And you look at, you know, the increase, slight increase in emissions last year, increase from dairy as well. But the dairy herd has increased 45% in the past decade. Is that sustainable?
It's absolutely not. Agriculture accounts for nearly 40% of our greenhouse gas emissions now, and they're going in completely the wrong direction. There was an increase in emissions last year. The pandemic didn't touch that. And they're backing themselves into a corner, in my opinion, on the size of the national herd. By the way, there is no such thing as a national herd. These are private assets held by enterprises. Even though they're very heavily publicly subsidised, they are... There is no national herd. Yeah. So we need to, farmers are also at the front line of climate change. They'll be the first ones to feel the effects of climate change when it does come to Ireland, and it is going to come to Ireland. And there's a huge opportunity for agriculture to diversify and become a meaningful part of being a low energy economy, tree planting, tourism, and so on.
And you mentioned the Climate Advisory Council, and we are waiting for their report, and we are waiting to see these carbon budgets, and there'll be a lot of fallout from that, obviously, between the various sectors. Shouldn't this have all happened sooner?
Well, things take time, and policies are being made.
Do you read anything into the delay then in seeing this climate action plan?
Well, four new members of the council were appointed just last week, so I think they need time to get their feet under the table, because it's a big weighty responsibility for them to recommend carbon budgets. So I'm not surprised it will take a little bit more time.
And there's going to be quite some reaction, isn't it, when those carbon budgets come out? And given that we've fallen so short on meeting our targets up to now, you know, how do we stop being climate laggards?
Well, we have to face the reality. And the reality is that in Ireland, we're living far beyond our means. If everybody in the world emitted the same amount as the average Irish person, the world would already have warmed by 3 degrees. That would bring huge catastrophe. So actually doing our part means everybody coming together, social solidarity, in the same way that COVID happened. So we all came together, we trust the science, and we believed the solutions were fair. And that same sort of big societal effort is needed now to meet the carbon budgets and meet our obligations.
It's a timely point. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on Morning Ireland, Dr. Hannah Daly, lecturer in energy systems at University College Cork.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Discover our 2-to-1 offers at your local Kia dealer. For more, log on to kia.com.
Morning Ireland, the time now, if I put my glasses on I could actually read the time actually. The time now is 22 minutes to 9, and Garen Frehal has the sports news.
Spot on, Anya. Good morning. The Irish team might have lost last night to Sweden, one of the best teams in the world, but so many positives to take from their 1-0 loss. It was always going to be a tough one against a team ranked second in the world, but I think the Irish can really consider themselves a little bit unlucky, and especially when you look at the goal that separated the sides, that all-important goal, an unfortunate own goal by Louise Quinn, and really nothing she could do about it. Brilliant performance. Unfortunately, though, one of our key players, Denise O'Sullivan, went off injured. It looked like a shoulder injury, and she now looks a doubt for that really important game away to Finland next Tuesday. Katie McCabe, skipper, has been talking to Tony O'Donoghue.
I think we stood out to them at times, especially in that second half when obviously we were pushing to get the equaliser, but look, we tried to make it as tough as possible for them, but I'm really proud of the team's performance today.
You showed us again tonight, though, that you are probably in the form of your life. Nutmegs and drag backs. I mean, you know, against a team ranked as highly as them, you showed no respect or fear for them.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I'm enjoying obviously the form I'm in at the minute with club, and I try to take that in to obviously the national team as well, but what's most important for me is to get results. So we'll look to obviously take the positives from tonight and into Tuesday.
Yeah, she really is in the form of her life, but as you can hear, disappointed not to get the result, and the Irish team setting high standards there at the moment. More live action tonight on RTE2, the extra.ie FAI Cup semi-finals. Bohemians and Waterford is the live match on television. St Pat's meet Dundalk, both at 7:45. And let's look ahead to these games now with former Sheffield Wednesday and Shamrock Rovers player Paul Corrie, who joins us. Let's get straight into it, Paul. That one live on the television tonight, Bohemians and Waterford. How do you see it going?
Yeah, morning, Darren. Had you asked me a couple of weeks ago, I guess I'd probably say Bohs would be a shoe-in for the final, but their form has been patchy of late, and that was probably best summed up against the game with Shamrock Rovers on Monday, where they were superb in the first half, really quick out of the blocks, and then their performance levels dropped off in the second half against the 10-man Shamrock Rovers. Now, that being said, they still have some serious firepower, particularly in the final third, and that relationship between Georgie Kelly, who's the league's top goal scorer, and Ross Tierney has really blossomed, and that's always supported really well from Ali Coote and Bert, who supply from wide areas. And Bohs, you know, were so impressive in that European run, Darren. People were raving about them in the Aviva when they played the Greek side, and Keith Long will be looking for much of the same tonight. But they have a stiff test. Mark Bertram has come in at Waterford, and they look at different sides since he's come in, completely different than the side at the beginning of the season, and bar a defeat against Shamrock Rovers, they actually haven't lost a game since August and have serious momentum behind them. So I guess when you put it all together, Waterford are going to prove a really stiff test for Bohs tonight. But it's probably one where I feel with the home fans behind Bohs and the atmosphere they create in Daly Mount, you match that with a banging form Georgie Kelly, I think they're just going to have enough to get through there, Darren.
Okay, and what about the other one, Pats and Dundalk? Toss of a coin between these two, do you think?
Yeah, I think you're bang on with that. Dundalk have come in and finally found a bit of form. They've won four and drawn two of their last six games. And Vinnie Perth finally seems as if he's settled on a formation and 11 players that he can rely on. I mean, you look at the league table and it's way off the standards of previous years. They sit in seventh. And yet at the same time, they very nearly knocked out Vitesse from Holland, who beat Tottenham Hotspur last night in the Conference League. So, kind of sums up their season that you don't really know what to expect. But when you look at the teams that are left in the competition, they've probably still got the strongest 11 players, and if they can find the performances, I probably feel as if, Darren, they're going to be very hard to stop along the way to actually retaining the cup. But that said, Pats have somewhat of a surprise package this season. Stevie O'Donnell's done an amazing job there, probably about 12 months ahead of schedule with regards to contending for titles. He's blooded really good youngsters like Zadara Burns, Alfie Lewis, James Obanqua with some core experienced players, but your gut would probably tell you it's probably a bit too soon for this Pats team. Dundalk, loads of experience on a big occasion. If Duffy, Hooban and Patrick can come to the fore, I probably feel as if they're going to have enough to produce on the night, and we'll see them to the final. So Dundalk and Bohs for me, Darren.
Okay, Paul Corrie, great to hear from you as always. Leinster are away to Glasgow tonight in the United Rugby Championship at 7:35. We heard from Stuart Lancaster earlier. Well, the big game this weekend is the clash of Connacht and Ulster at the Aviva Stadium. A home from home for the night for Jack Harty.
I have lots of buddies up in Dublin who kind of use Galway as an excuse not to come down, so I'll be hoping that they'll actually manage to get to a game. But yeah, Ulster have got bonus points every game so far. The brand of rugby they're playing, exciting new players coming through, so we're fully aware of their threats, but ultimately it's a celebration for Connacht Rugby, so we want to repay the fans who unfortunately weren't here during COVID.
Former Cork Ladies football manager Efi Fitzgerald is the new manager of the Waterford men's football team. Leona Maguire's second round of 72. She's 2 under par at the BMW Championship in South Korea down the field. Jonathan Caldwell is in a tie for 14th at the Mallorca Open. He's 4 under par. Paul Dunn, a shot further back. Ireland face Namibia finally in the T20 World Cup, and only a win will see them progress to the next phase of the competition. 11 a.m. start, Irish time. Back to you, Mary.
To the US now, and the Hollywood actor Alec Baldwin fired a prop gun that killed a cinematographer and wounded the director on a film set in New Mexico. Anusha Sakui of the LA Times has been telling me more.
So, as you mentioned, this film, it's called Rust. It's a Western that's being shot in New Mexico. What's being reported and about from the Santa Fe County Sheriff's Office is that the actor, Alec Baldwin, who is also a producer on that film, fired a prop gun on the set, which killed the director of photography called Helena Hutchins, who was 42, and injured the director, Joel Souza, who is 48.
This is quite shocking. Is there any further information on how this could happen?
There isn't at the moment. All we know at this time is that no charges have been filed, but the sheriff's office is interviewing, you know, witnesses. Production is obviously halted now on what was a, you know, low budget movie which began filming earlier this month.
What are people in the movie industry saying around the use of prop guns? People will be surprised to think that a prop gun shooting blanks would have the capacity to kill someone.
Obviously, it's rare, and there are a lot of safety protocols around weapons on set that should keep people safe. There have been terrible accidents on film sets. You know, back in 1993, Brandon Lee, the son of the late martial arts star Bruce Lee, he died hit by a 44 caliber. Slug while filming a death scene for the movie The Crow. Bruce Lee's daughter Shannon Lee actually paid a tribute to Hutchins and Sousa today after hearing of the incident, and she said, you know, no one should ever be killed by a gun on a film set. And it's just, we don't know what's happened on this film set, and how it's possible that these two could have been injured or killed.
And we have to await further investigations. Alec Baldwin, of course, a hugely successful actor who's reached, I suppose, a whole new audience in recent years with his impersonations of Donald Trump on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, I mean, he's obviously a household name, and he was producing this movie and so would have had a heightened role in it. And, obviously is, you know, well known for, his roles on SNL as, you know, doing the Donald Trump impressions recently, but also for his NBC show 30 Rock on NBC, which he and Tina Fey made into a hilarious comedy.
Anoosheh Sakhoui of the LA Times there joining me a little earlier now.
You see, that's not the normal sound you hear on Morning Ireland of a Friday, is it? Welcome back to the New York Brass Band from York. Of course, they're playing Happy, and there is a great sense of happiness here in Cork this weekend. And joining me, Fiona Collins, the chairperson of the Cork Jazz Festival Committee, and a very happy weekend for you, Fiona, getting it back. And also Pascal Sheehy, our Southern editor, who gave us that report on the reopening here earlier in the programme. Fiona, the first post-pandemic post-lockdown, because the pandemic to some large extent is still with us. So, happiness, obviously. Nervousness, was it really hard putting this jazz together?
Definitely. Happiness, nervousness, excitement, all coming together, definitely. There's always a slight apprehension about it. We'd looked at planning for the festival before the restrictions were to be lifted, so we were definitely going to do something. But then when we heard about the restrictions being lifted, we worked towards that, always with it, you know, the expectation that it might be revised. We were working towards that. But there's definitely an excitement. There's a buzz in the air in Cork again, back for the weekend, and I'm just thrilled to see it. Yeah. Really thrilled.
You can see it in the smile on your face as well. And Pascal, while there is a lot of nervousness, and Mary Favier was talking to us about that, and Paul Reed as well, you also got the sense walking around last night that this was nearly something that couldn't be held back.
Yeah, there's a balance of need going on here at the moment. There is an apprehension about reopening and things like that, but at least that's taking place in a regulated manner in nightclubs and in bars and clubs and things like that. I will remind people about the pictures we saw in this city from last summer when thousands of people were gathering in the Docklands in Cork on Fridays, Saturdays and Sunday nights in a completely unregulated fashion. Now, that was an accident waiting to happen, and I think everybody recognised that. So while there is maybe a sense of apprehension ahead of reopening, at least it's happening in a regulated fashion.
Indeed. And one of the things we were talking to Deirdre O'Shaughnessy about earlier was the various roadworks and transport works and infrastructure works that are going on here in Cork. In terms of development, what impact has lockdown had? What's the story?
Well, the changes that the roadworks, the airport redevelopment, the works even on the rail line coming into the city, that's part of a range of transformational change currently taking place in this city. And to put it in context, the sort of change that you saw in the Docklands area of Dublin in the late 90s and the early noughties, that is now taking place here in Cork to build a counterbalance to Dublin. 350 million, a third of a billion euro in state funding has been announced for the Docklands and Cork, and that will give way to 5 billion euro in over the next 20 years. And we've already seen this. This is taking place just a few hundred metres away. Number one, Albert Quay, Horgan's Quay, big office development, Albert Quay, Penrose Dock, Navigation Square. So the whole Docklands area of the city is being transformed before our eyes as we speak. On a wider level, in IDA-backed companies, there were more people employed in IDA-backed companies in Cork last year than there ever was before. It's almost double what it was in 2010, and there is every evidence. 17 investment and jobs projects already for the city. There is every evidence here that the bounce back will be quick.
Indeed, and that's something indeed many people here will be looking forward to, but looking forward to more immediately this weekend, Fiona. Tell us about some of the highlights and tell us what will be the same, what will be different this jazz.
So this weekend we have 60 venues taking place, or 60 venues taking part, I should say. We have acts like Matthew Halsall, Hypnotic Brass Ensemble taking place in the Opera House and in the Everyman. You have all the different pubs across the city taking part. For me, one of my favourite parts of the weekend is actually the jazz bands on the street, the likes of the lovely band you hear behind us. You know, they're going to be playing pop-ups and on the stage in Emmett Place over the weekend. So, you know, just coming into the city and getting a feel for the festival and seeing the bands on the streets is definitely one of my favourite parts of the festival.
What's the economic bounce it gives to the city of Cork?
It's around 25 million. It's really hard to put a figure on because, you know, there's the official spend from the budget, from the festival and what that is. And then you have, you know, that indirect spend as well, what happens in the rest of the city over the weekend. So it's very hard to put a figure on, but it's estimated to be around 25 million.
And it is something, I mean, you come here these jazz weekends in Cork, Pascal, they are just something unique, aren't they?
They're quite unique. It's something that's intrinsic to the city. We didn't have one last year, and there's a huge sense of anticipation in terms of what we're going to see over the next two or three days.
Well, thank you both for joining us to talk about it this morning, and we hope indeed that everybody has a safe as well as a very happy next couple of weekends. Thank you to our band, the New York Bass Band. They'll be playing here at the Jazz over the weekend, and they'll play us out now.